Good afternoon. So last time we finished talking about pipes and pipelines and tricky things that might happen with pipes, like if you make them after forking instead of before. Then we started talking about our intro to scheduling, first looking at the states that processes could have in XV6 in general in our scheduler. And talking about how XV6 organizes a scheduler. We saw that it had a separate thread to run the scheduler. And the idea was that we'd switch to that thread to decide what to run next, and then we'd switch from that thread to the thing we're actually running next. And that's how scheduling would work. We talked about the general idea that we have multiple queues when we're thinking about scheduling in general. That we'll mostly be talking about this notion of a ready queue, things that are ready to run on a processor, but we also have like a queue waiting to use the disk and other things that we have might have multiple programs waiting for, and we need to make a scheduling decision about who gets to go first, who to take off that queue, and that's what our scheduling is. And then we started talking specifically about our particular scheduling problem with I/O and CPU burst. The notion that we're talking about scheduling things like on a desktop, and they'll generally do a little bit of computation, like in response to a key press, and then switch back to doing I/O. So we can think of that our scheduling problem is that we have a bunch of these CPU bursts to run, these little pieces of work that are ready because some I/O happened, or possibly big pieces of work. And the question is, when do we run those on our CPU? And that's the main scheduling problem we'll look at. Yes?
I just had a question about the homework.
Okay.
It says submit on Colab, but there's no like assignments to follow
through. Does it say submit on Colab? It shouldn't. It should say submit on the same place you submitted homework, the XV6 intro. I hope. If not, I will correct that. Homeworks show. Oh, yep, I say Colab for no reason. I mean to submit to the same place you submitted XV6 intro. I will make sure that gets updated. Let's just do that right now. So, in other words about me messing things up, I made a big mistake on the VM that I'm really embarrassed about. I thought I started from a clean VM. I actually started from a VM I tested a handful of mostly broken student submissions on. So there's some files in the home directory. Please delete them. We know they're there. If you use them, we'll be able to tell. So, for future assignments, just delete them, ignore them, I'm sorry. And if you have any questions, concerns, if you looked at things, whatever, talk to me privately. We can do something about it. But I just thought I started, had not used the VM I started with for anything, and it turns out I had used it to like double check some broken submissions were broken and things like that. And that infrastructure worked. And you should delete them because the assignments are changed this semester too, so you don't want to confuse yourself for that reason. Just a note on that, some people discovered this by accidentally submitting a tar file that's in the home directory that's from last semester and for the wrong assignment. Just because they weren't paying attention to what they were uploading, which is, you know, I'll let you upload the right thing. I know you didn't intend to do that, since obviously you would not submit something for the wrong assignment. Just talking about that. Okay, that's my logistical note. Any questions right away? Okay. And I haven't updated VM, which doesn't have this problem if you download a new one. That's me not checking things that now I've learned to check for the future. Okay, so last time we were talking, ended up talking about CPU bursts. So this is for interactive programs. We think of it as we do a little bit of work in response to IOs. If we have a program which is just doing computation, obviously it's not going to work that way. It's going to end up, it's just going to run forever. And we see that we have this sort of, this variety of amounts of times programs run. These buckets are sort of powers of two. So like it's kind of even on a log scale. So we have a wide range. Not kind of even log, it's log scale. So it's hard to tell, but we have a wide range. We have some stuff that runs for a long time. And most stuff runs for a short time. And these are the lengths of the CPU bursts. So at any point in time, we'll have a bunch of programs that are ready to run, possibly just one, in which case our scheduling decision's easy, possibly a whole bunch of things, and they all have some amount of compute time to run. And I'm just gonna start with the scenario that I have a list of things that are ready to run and how much time there'll be to run. So our typical original view is that we have a bunch of CPU bursts in our queue, a bunch of programs, and we know that each program has a certain amount of CPU to use, and then it's gonna be done, and then it's gonna wait for IO again. And our task is, what is the best choice for when we have multiple programs that are ready to run next? So we had like our one program which like is ready to run because it just received something from the network, another which is ready to run because I just moved my mouse and it needs to update the screen, you know. So we have like those two programs. Which one do we run first? Okay. And so that's the task we'll be thinking about. So we're gonna have several different types of metrics. So one is going to be response or turnaround time. And this is dealing with the time from when I do my IO to when I'm finally done doing the computation based on that. So we can think of this, I press a button on my keyboard, how long until something displays in my screen as a result of that command, and that finishes. This we'll call turnaround, I will call turnaround time. Anderson Dahlin calls it response time. And Arpeggi Dasu, the other book, the one that's a free PDF, uses response time to mean something different. So I'm gonna use the term turnaround time to not be, to be unambiguous. But it's what the Anderson Dahlin calls response time. So this is one notion where we're talking about how responsive is it to my key presses and so on. So this is like, that's our intuition is that this is like, how useful is it for me as a user in some sense. We have another notion which is throughput. And this is the total amount of work we get done. So the idea here is that I want my CPU to always be doing something useful. And I want to minimize the time it's not doing something useful. And we're gonna have what we'll call overhead, time where we're doing things that is not our real work. And the biggest source of overhead that we're gonna be concerned about is from context switching. That when I run one program and switch to another, you know, that switch takes some time. We saw that we have to like push a bunch of things on the stack. We're switching between two user programs. We have to save all the registers on the one kernel stack, restore them from another. That takes a bunch of time, and we don't want to be doing that all the time. And because of that, this goal of having a low turnaround time, of responding to my key presses quickly, is going to be in conflict with the goal of having a high throughput. Because to respond to things quickly, I'm gonna need to switch between programs more often. And that means I'm gonna spend more time doing the switching, which means I'm gonna get less work out of my processor. So these are inherently in conflict in general. So there's another type of metric we'll be concerned about, which doesn't have such an obvious number version, which is fairness. And the idea of fairness is that if two people are sharing a machine, like if you and I are both logged into a department machine via SSH, we should both get our fair share, whatever that means. Maybe we should get an equal share, maybe someone should get twice as much, but there's some notion of the correct share each user should get. And the question is whether the scheduler does that. And this will be in conflict with these other goals, that giving you the lowest possible response time means that it's going to hurt me in my performance. It's going to mean that sometimes I'm going to run slower. You know, so there's conflict there. Giving fairly sharing between users means we're going to have to switch more often, so it's in conflict with throughput. So we're going to end up, you know, if you want fairness, we're going to compromise some on these other metrics. And so we want these metrics. Our goal here is that we're going to have a bunch of choices for what to do, and we're going to evaluate them based on how well do they satisfy these goals. Okay. So let's start with our first notion, which is looking at turnaround time. And I'll also talk about something related called wait time. So turnaround time is the time from when we have our program gets ready to when it finishes. And in between that time, we think if we have this CPU burst, that CPU burst might not run all at once. We might start running the program for a bit, then decide to switch to something else, then switch back, and then it finishes that chunk of computation it could do. But the important thing is that this is the time from when the program was ready, waiting for input, till when it actually was waiting for input again. So another metric which is related, which I'll call wait time, is the time the program was waiting in total, which is just the total turnaround time minus the time it actually ran. Yeah?
So does that wait time usually come from switching to other programs?
So the wait time is just the time it's not running. So note that it includes this time where you're waiting initially. And often that will be the only wait time. We'll generally just talk about turnaround time because for the most of the measures we care about, improving turnaround time improves wait time in all cases. It's not guaranteed, but for the things we care about, it is. Yeah.
Why don't we consider the ready section? Mm-hmm.
We do. This turnaround time starts here and ends here. And the wait time starts here, ends here, then starts here, ends here. It's all the ready section. We don't consider the time where we're waiting for input part of the time though at all. That's the important part. That if the program can't be on the CPU, we don't count it. Yeah?
So are we running, is other program taking up the CPU time?
So the question is, what's happening in the time that's red, the ready time? And, well, it's not running, so hopefully something else is on the CPU, but I haven't specified that. Like, maybe we have the most horrible scheduler ever, and it says we have one thing ready, we're not gonna run anything. You know, that's an option. Probably you wouldn't be happy with that scheduler, but that's an option. Maybe if we had some other metrics we cared about, like maybe if power was our metric, that might be a thing we'd actually do. So most commonly, we're going to look at mean turnaround time or total turnaround time. Note that minimizing the total turnaround time is the same as minimizing the mean. So we can talk about them interchangeably. And this is also the same as minimizing the total or mean waiting time. So as long as we're concerned about the mean, this wait time and turnaround time are the same. If we're concerned about like what's the 90th percentile or the median, they're different. But we're going to mostly be concerned about the mean or the total, which is why I said that we're going to be optimizing them at the same time. It doesn't matter which one you think about. So one way we can think about turnaround time is that it's the time it takes to start the next I/O in their CPU burst model. It's the time from when one I/O finishes to when the next I/O that program does starts. And it's this notion which tells us that this is the schedule we want if what we're concerned about is both user responsiveness or just fully utilizing something like a disk. You know, if we want the disk to always be busy, we want to minimize this time. So maybe it's better for not the efficiency of the CPU, but the efficiency of other I/O devices. And this is different than you'd have in other contexts, like if you're thinking of a batch program in a cluster, it's how long does the user wait for like something long. So we could use that measurement there, even though we'll mostly talk about sort of this CPU burst context. And I guess something to note about realistic scenarios is that I point out here that if we have a so if you think of a program that's like reading from a hard disk, a faster turnaround time means it, you know, means that it does more I/O, so it gets to use the CPU more. You know, so it's not that, so like, if you want to like model this fully, you need to know how fast is the disk, how fast is the program. You can't just say the program it needs to start running at this time and this time and this time. We're gonna mostly look at this as more of a simple model. So we're gonna start out by just thinking about, we have some things to run now and we're not gonna be concerned about what happens based on when they finish. Let's talk about throughput. So throughput is where, you know, we have our main concern of context switches. So it's useful work done, and this context switch is our most notable form of not useful work. So there's some other considerations that we might think of when talking about throughput that we mostly won't be modeling, but are things that when you're thinking of a real scheduler, you care about. So one example is cold caches. If you remember how the cache works, our program runs a lot faster when its data is in the L1 and the L2 cache. And if it's running for a while, it's going to be there. But if we haven't started the program recently on the CPU, it's going to have some amount of time where we're going to be running slow. And if we're trying to measure schedulers carefully, that's actually a big part of the cost of a context switch. That even though like loading things from the stack into registers and all that stuff takes a bunch of time, like a lot of the time is actually going to be spent just moving stuff into the cache, and that will cost often many times the actual direct context switch cost. And of course that cost will vary depending on what program you're running. If you're running a program which doesn't store anything in memory, everything's in registers, well, it doesn't care about that. So the other thing is fairness. So fairness is a tricky thing to define. And we'll talk about some definitions a bit later. But usually you have an intuitive notion. So which of these schedules is fairer? If assuming different users. So probably most of you think the second one. So it's easy to answer. We'll have a formal definition. A possible formal definition later. It turns out there's a whole lot of ways of defining what fairness means. And for cases like this, like they give you the same answer pretty much, but there's other cases where it's harder to figure out what should be the answer as for what's fair. Okay, so we're gonna start out by talking about two trivial scheduling algorithms. First come, first served, and round robin. And one of these is what Xv6 implements. And we're just gonna say, for all these examples I'm gonna show you, I'm doing the CPU burst model where we have a bunch of programs which are ready to run their CPU bursts, and I am writing down how long that CPU burst is, and we're not gonna be concerned about new programs being ready to run at any point. We'll deal with that later, that is a concern, but for now we're just saying we have a set of programs that need to use the CPU now, and that's all the programs we care about ever. And they're also going to be in some order. The notion would be that we have a queue of running processes and it's a linked list, is probably the simplest way of thinking about it. So first come, first serve is probably the simplest possible scheduling algorithm. And this is going to mean have no preemption. So preemption means we might stop running a program and switch to another. We think of this like a program writes too long, you're running an infinite loop. Yeah, we switch to another program even though you didn't do anything that gave up the CPU. So in this model, we're not going to do preemption. We're not going to have that timer interrupting. We're just going to keep running a program until it's done, until it's ready to give up the CPU. And sometimes you might need to do this, like if you don't have enough memory to store two programs in memory, this is what you want to do. You don't want to keep switching. It's fine. So here's my three program processes, A, B, and C, and the amount of CPU time they need for their CPU burst. So we say A is CPU bound, and B and C look kind of not CPU bound based on this. That would be our notion, that A seems to be doing big computations relative to the other programs, which are just doing little bits of work, like maybe to show something to the user. We can't tell exactly, but they seem like they're interactive in some way. So our first come, first served, also known as FIFO, first in, first out schedule, just uses the scheduler, the ready queue, as a normal queue. So it's going to run them in order. It's not going to switch between away from them. Just going to run it to completion until it's done with those IO. So if they arrive in ABC order, this is what we get. So let's go through our metrics from earlier. So let's look at the waiting times. So B is waiting for 24 units. And C is waiting for 24 plus 4 units, so 28 units, which means our mean waiting time is 17.3 because A waits for 0. We can similarly compute the turnaround times. A takes 24 units of time to run, B takes 28, and C takes 31, so our mean is 27.7, assuming I didn't mess up the calculation when making the slide. Yeah.
Is there a way to know how much CPU time you would need ahead of time, or is that something you have to like calculate?
So the question is, could we know how much CPU time there is ahead of time? Not in general. We'll talk about what we can do about that problem later. But first, let's look at the effects of the varying times. So another thing, order we could have, is let's say things arrived in the order BCA. In that case, B is waiting for no time. C is waiting for 4 units of time, and A is waiting for 7 units of time. So we have a much lower mean waiting time and mean turnaround time. So the advantage of this scheduling algorithm is that it was really simple, but here you can see why you might not be happy with it. That if you're concerned about turnaround or response time, or waiting time, then you're going to sometimes have very good results and sometimes have very bad results. On the other hand, as far as if we think about throughput, well, we're doing the minimum number of context switches. We have to switch at least twice to run all these three programs, and we're doing exactly that number of switches. So we'll call this the problem we see here the convoy effect, that B and C wait behind the convoy of A is what we think of it as. That the problem we have here, which gives us our really bad response and waiting times, waiting and turnaround times, is that we had this long A task that delayed these short things which should have run earlier. And we'll think about that later. And we'll first look at sort of a partial solution to this, which is going to address this problem without dealing with the issue you were mentioning of how do we know how long things run. We're not going to measure that. We're just going to do a policy which is going to avoid having us wait forever for some program to run, and that's by adding back preemption, that we're going to say, A, you've used the CPU for too long, other people are waiting, we're going to let them run now. And we're going to talk about the simplest policy for this, and in fact it's XV6's scheduling policy, which is round robin. So you run the program until either it can't run anymore, or it ran for too long. And then you run a different the next program in the list. So this is the policy SP6 implements. When we switch to the scheduler, we always run the next available program in the list. And we switch to the scheduler either when the program gives up the CPU, like to read, or when the program decides to, when the program exceeds its time limit and a timer interrupt happens, and then we switch. So this is harder to implement than our first come, first serve, because we need a way of stopping programs. We need context switches, which we didn't actually need before. Like, we could rely on the program getting to a stopping point, so we didn't need to save all its registers, potentially. And we need a way of interrupting programs to enforce the time limit. XP6, we mentioned, has both of those. We have interrupts, which can stop a program in the middle, and we can save a program state no matter what it's doing, even if it's not doing a system call where it expects to be stopped. So let's look at what happens with round robin with a time quantum of 1 unit. So here we have the same arrival order, ABC. We run A, it runs for 1 unit, and we say the time quantum of 1 unit is the limit on the amount of time it can run. This is what we mean by too long. So we're saying it ran for 1 unit, that's too long. We switch to B, then we switch to C, then we switch to A, and so on. And we keep doing this until the program eventually runs out of CPU work to do for each of these programs. And we can see this order BCA, and we can see that these result in similar finishing times for each of these programs. They don't finish at quite the same time. That B finishes a little later with the order which had a problem before than here, but we've minimized the effect by having this policy of saying we're not going to let programs run for too long, and we've kind of made this more fair. If you think about fairness, this is a lot more fair because, you know, as long as the programs have work to do, they're getting to run more evenly, splitting up the CPU. If we think about throughput, this is really bad because we're doing lots more context switches, and if we think those have a cost, well, we're paying that cost many, many more times. But from a waiting and turnaround time, we've kind of done okay no matter what order things come in. So questions on schedules here? Yeah. So the question is, will the scheduler have the time quantum? We'll start with that one. The answer is sometimes. The simplest thing is to have something like a fixed time quantum. XP6 doesn't quite do that, because XP6's notion of when to switch is when the timer interrupt happens, which is just periodically. So if you don't happen to start from a timer interrupt, you'll have a little less than that time. But it's close to saying that one fixed time quantum. Many OSs will actually just like set a new timer when they start running a program to enforce this, in which case you'll have an actual fixed time quantum. But I've kind of glossed over the issues of like exactly how fixed it is, mostly because it varies. And you had another question? Other? Okay. So we can also have different time quantums, which will give us sort of a compromise that we're going to get a bit worse rating and response times when we have these bad orders, when we have A first, because we're going to wait behind A longer for B and C. But we're going to do a lot less context switching. So that's sort of the compromise we're making, is whether we see this bad part of the convoy effect where we can have this long thing we wait behind as much, versus do we see low throughput because we're switching between programs all the time and spending all our time doing that. And notice that following my rule for what round robin does, this case right here, C starts running, it has one unit of work left to do, it runs for one unit, it doesn't run for two, even though, you know, it had a longer amount of time available to it. Okay, so questions? Yeah.
Instead of waiting for the interrupt every X amount of seconds or whatever have you, can you manually give control back to the scheduler?
The question is, can you manually give control back to the scheduler? Absolutely. And you do this all the time. If you think of like calling a read when the user hasn't pressed a key, that's giving control back to the scheduler. We also, XV6, the version of XV6 you have, I added a system call to do the, give control back to the scheduler called yield, which calls the same yield function that a timer interrupt does. And a lot of OSs have a system call like that also, but most simply you can give control back to the OS by just waiting for some event.
So when you call the yield, does it come to the next line underneath that yield, or does it start the whole thing?
The question, when you call yield, does it come to the next line under?
When it comes back to that program.
It start comes back returning from the system call, just like for read. Think of read, like run something else, but it's the same idea, or sleep if you know about that. Same idea, we run a system call, the system call returns after we decide to switch back from the scheduler to our program. Okay, so that's round robin. So we choose some time quantum somehow, and we switch to the next thing, and this is exactly what XV6 does. So the big question is, what do we choose for our time quantum? We know we have this compromise where if we have a really short time quantum, we're gonna have lots and lots of context switches, but the orders aren't gonna matter. In this sense, we're gonna be more fair. We're gonna fairly share between the available programs in that sense. And we're gonna be more likely to have like at least reasonable response time for all programs versus some program getting unlucky. And if we have the time quantum really, really long, if we set the time quantum to infinity, it's exactly first come, first served. So we can get something closer and closer to first come, first served by making our time quantum bigger and bigger, where we're gonna have higher throughput because we're gonna context switch less, but we're gonna have this problem that we favor the first program a lot. And that potentially might mean the other programs are at a real disadvantage and have this much higher turnaround time. Yeah?
Is that what the convoy effect was? That
yeah. The convoy effect was, yeah, waiting behind that long program. Okay. And one way we can think about the fairness if we know the number of things that are running, we can bound the amount of time until you get to use the CPU next. So this is one formal way of saying how fair things are. We could compare this with other schedulers and say, well, if you have n things running, how long might you have to wait for the CPU? And in some way, if you have to wait less time, that's in some sense more fair. But as I said, we'll talk more about definitions of fairness later. So one thing we're considering here is how bad are context switches? So this is a worthwhile thing to talk about. And we sort of have an intuitive notion based on looking at the XV6 code, which does a context switch. Like you might be able to guess like how many instructions it is and so on, but that's not a substitute for actually measuring things. And it's really tricky to measure because most of the costs of the context switch are these indirect costs like cache misses. So typical measurements say that it's between like 0.01 milliseconds and 0.1 milliseconds, so like 10 and 100 microseconds, but it depends what you're running. And real systems are gonna choose time quantums when they're doing things which are round robin or like round robin to manage this overhead. So for example, Linux chooses between time quantums between 0.75 and 6 milliseconds by default, which is, you know, trying to make a compromise between making sure that this 0.1 milliseconds doesn't become too much of your time versus you know, writing things quickly. And often you might see values from like 1 to 100 milliseconds, you know, which are all just about how much are you avoiding this context switch cost. Yeah.
So the typical context switch, you don't really know exactly how long it's going to take, and you don't know how much CPU time each process is going to take, so you're just kind of guessing what would be a good value. Like, what variable is...
So the question is, like, what variables used to decide? So we'll talk later about what factors Linux uses to decide between this range. And it's not going to be a nice, elegant answer like you might like. It's going to be sort of heuristic based on just what the, just based on hope making whatever the cost is in this range typical. It's not going to be based on measuring it. Because that's typical, like, I have these measurements, but getting measurements of overhead requires knowing what the application is trying to do. Like, so you can't just do it generically in your operating system. Overhead from caches, rather, you know, requires knowing, like, what would the cache hit rate be if the program didn't get context switched? Like, and that's hard to know, like, just for measuring, like, how much the cache misses. Okay, so we've talked about throughput and fairness, but what about our last metric, which is waiting time and turnaround time? Yeah, which we said mean waiting time and turnaround time are the same. That's what we'll be concerned with. So let's think about this. So if we think about round robin, and we think about adjusting that time quantum, how does it change the average turnaround time? Which is the same as the average waiting time, as far as the direction it goes. And the answer might depend on what we're running, which is why I have stay the same as an option. So most simply, like, it can stay the same if we're running exactly one program. Like, if there's no context switch overhead, doesn't matter what the quantum is. So I'll give you some time to think about this. So which option is correct here? Or what's the effect of the quantum on? The turnaround time, the average turnaround time, by which I mean mean.
The best answer.
Okay, so who thinks, like, A is the best answer here? B? C? Okay, something else? No, okay. So can someone give me an example of how it can decrease? A lot of people said A, so can you give me an example? Yeah. Okay, so I see your switch back. So can you give me like an example of like what would that schedule look like that benefits? So we have a program running, and then you're concerned that we switch away from the program to run something else and switch back versus we have a longer time quantum.
Oh yeah, so like
and
the non-solid process, like, would be ready during, well, the how the process is running, but I wouldn't have to wait as long for it to come back.
Okay, so yeah, so you're concerned about considering something like, I guess we'll take like this versus something like like this, which I have a more worked out example, another simple case. An even simpler case is if we think about B here, if B is waiting behind A, lower quantum means B runs for earlier to begin with. Yeah?
Is the context switch time, is that kind of part of your wait time, or is that like?
So the context switch time would be part of your wait and turnaround time, all the context switches you need to wait for. For this problem, we explicitly say to say if there were no context switch overhead, so we're ignoring that, because that would definitely complicate things. So it's an example of decreasing. So some people said it could also increase. Someone have an example? Yeah. Okay, so you observed that when I was here, BCA, we had a wait time of 3.7 and a turnaround time of 14, mean. And when we switched to round robin with the same order, you were paying attention, you saw that this crept up, and it crept up because intuitively we had this A here, which now we B has to wait for A to run for a little bit before it finishes, whereas before it didn't. So, and that's, we've also come up with some simpler examples. So even if things take the same amount of time, like we have, if we do shorter time quantums, A and B finish at closer to the same time, so it's fairer, like we expect, but this means that A takes longer and B takes the same amount of time, so we end up taking longer time overall. So we saw, some examples where it can increase the time. So we can increase the time when our original order wasn't bad for turnaround time, and round robin effectively makes us wait for this thing which would have gone last that takes a long time. It won't finish. It just makes us take more time. And also, it can stay the same. The simplest example is something like this. We have two things which use 1 unit of time, and we start with a time quantum longer than they take. Decreasing it won't do anything. Okay, so round robin doesn't actually tell you what happens to, doesn't like, adjusting the time quantum isn't actually a great way of fixing your turnaround time if that's your goal. Like, it does something, but what it does varies. So what do we actually want to do for fixing turnaround time? And this goes, we should go to the observation that, well, arrival order mattered. And let's go through, through our arrival orders, and this slide has an incorrectly labeled arrival order. So we have our various arrival orders, and we see that of the three arrival orders I have here, this one is best. And this one is worst. And what they're doing is the worst one, we put the longest thing first, so as many things as possible have to wait for it. And then we put the next longest thing, so as many things possible have to wait for that. So that's how we're maximizing our turnaround time. That's not what we want to do. So our best order, we put the shortest thing first, so we have as little wait, little amount of stuff that everything else needs to wait for. So we're minimizing our turnaround time by making sure that, we're running this so nothing else can run. So we'll make sure that the thing we're running takes the least amount of time so the other things have the least contribution to their total waiting time. And we just keep doing that. So generally, we're gonna get our best turnaround and best waiting time in total by running the shortest CPU burst first and our worst if we run the longest one first. And one way you can think about this is as a race to go to sleep, that we want to have every process get to sleep as soon as possible in order to not be, to minimize our turnaround time. That's what we're doing. So you want to run whatever will get something to sleep as soon as possible, which is always the thing with the shortest CPU burst. Okay. And we'll come back to this a bit later. But first, a diversion into some other scheduling algorithms and some completely different scheduling metrics, which will then tie back to this observation. But any questions on this, why this optimizes turnaround time first? Yeah.
In order to do this ordering, don't we need to also do sort of a pre-processing?
So the question is, how do we actually do this ordering? That is a good question, and we'll answer that eventually. And the answer is, we'll guess. Educated guess, but we'll guess. But for now, we're going to assume we know, just to keep things simpler. So first, my diversion. So there's another set of scheduling algorithms, which are based on sort of a notion where we have priorities between different users or programs. For example, I might just statically say, my shell is more important than that long computation you're going to run for 4 days. I want my shell to run when I'm running a command. Like, that might be my scheduling policy. That's a reasonable policy. I might say faculty jobs are more important than student jobs. Faculty should get to use the CPU before we give student CPU cycles. That might be a policy we have. No. So our scheduling algorithm is when we have a choice, schedule shells and faculty programs first, everything else later. And this is sort of can be generalized to this notion of priority scheduling. We assign every process or thread a priority, and we have a queue for each priority. And we just choose from the highest priority which queue to use, and we use some scheduling algorithm in that queue. So for example, maybe in this case, we'll take from priority 15, and we'll run the processes with priority 15 in a round robin fashion. We'll give them a time quantum and switch between them, those two. But we always run the highest priority thing first and go down the list until we find something we can run. So if there's something at priority 15, it gets run, assuming 15 is the most important priority. And only things at lower priorities only get run if there's nothing at the higher priorities. So this is a very common scheduling algorithm. It's very different from anything we've seen before because we're not optimizing for throughput or turnaround time or fairness. We have a very different metric which we're encoding to optimize. Often this is preemptive. Which means that when a higher priority program becomes ready, for example, it's reading from the keyboard and I press a key, we'll make a choice to stop whatever else is running and run it. Usually these systems that implement this kind of scheduling are going to do that kind of preemption, not always, but usually they will, meaning that, as part of handling that key press, we'll switch to the program if it's higher priority. If it's not, we won't. Program that wasn't runnable before. Okay, so now that we know about priority scheduling, let's say we have two processes. We have process A, which does one time unit of I/O, then 10 time units of CPU, then one time unit of I/O, then 10 time units of CPU, and runs forever. And we have process C, which runs at the lowest priority and has 4,000 time units of CPU. It doesn't do any I/O, it's just a big computation. How long will process C take to complete? Yeah. never will. So let's look at the schedule at the beginning. So process A starts. It runs for 10 units of time. Then it does I/O. And during this I/O, process C can run. So it does get to run, and this will keep happening. So it will complete, but it's going to complete at like 1/10 speed, basically. So that's going to take around 40,000 units of time. Questions on Zout? Yeah.
Just kind of in general, if process Z started and there was no process A, and all of a sudden process A comes, does it interrupt process Z, or is it wait?
So let's assume, priority scheduling is usually preemptive, so let's assume it's preemptive. If it's preemptive, yes. If it's not, no. Usually priority scheduling will be preemptive, so process A will interrupt it. Because usually the notion is if you have these priorities, you want them to matter all the time. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's change this now. So let's say we have process A at our highest priority, which does 1 unit of I/O, 10 of CPU, 1 of I/O, 10 of CPU. Process B at the second highest priority, which does 1 unit of I/O, 10 of CPU, 1 unit of I/O, 10 of CPU, and then process C. How long will process C take now? So I said forever, yes. So now we have the problem where in every, so process A runs in this pattern, but in every hole we run a bit of process B. And when process B, yes, sometimes does I/O, but when it does I/O, probably process C takes forever or close to forever. Maybe sometimes the I/O doesn't quite works out, so they're both doing I/O at the same time, when we get really lucky, but probably not. So this is a problem known as starvation. So a process can be starved of all resources. With priority scheduling. So this is something which didn't happen in first come, first served or round robin. You were guaranteed that if you were in line for first come, first served, even though there was no preemption, eventually you'd run, assuming there wasn't an infinite loop in front of you. That's not true here. Here, you can be starved of resources even if all the programs involved give up the CPU. Like, you might never get the CPU because of the competing programs. And this is a reason why we were concerned about fairness originally, that if you don't look for fairness and you do optimize something like this, you're not going to get it. In fact, you get sort of the worst possible fairness that this other program never, ever runs, which maybe is what you wanted, but that's what you get. Okay, but we have this notion of priority scheduling with this risk of starvation. So let's apply priority scheduling and combine this with our observation that we made before we went to this topic, that the best turnaround time comes from writing the shortest CPU burst first. So here I'm going to have my new scheduler is going to be called shortest job first. I'm going to do priority scheduling where my priority is determined by the length of the CPU burst. Shortest CPU burst have higher priorities. And this is exactly what's going to minimize turnaround time. We'll start with thinking about this without preemption. Okay, and as people have pointed out, doing this in practice is a bit problematic because we have to know how long a CPU burst is going to be, and we have to look inside the program and run it to do that, basically. And that would kind of defeat the point of having a scheduling decision if we run the program to figure out what program to run. So we're not going to do that. We'll deal with this problem later, sort of. So let's look at what this policy would be, and we're going to deal with that notion I showed you earlier now of programs that do repeated I/O and CPU. So each of these programs has just a pattern of alternating CPU and I/O that they're going to do, and we're going to schedule them according to our shortest job first, which means that program B is shortest, so it runs first, then program C, then program A, because of the length of its CPU burst. This makes sense? Questions? And for now, we're not going to do preemption. We're going to say that we only context switch when a program is done. We'll add preemption in a bit. So what this looks like is we run program B. It starts with I/O and it finishes over here. Then we run program C and it starts with I/O, which finishes over here. Then we run program A, and while program A is running, program C's I/O finishes. But because we're not doing preemption yet, we don't run program C yet. We just leave things as is. Then program C, B runs after that because now program B is waiting, so we run it. And while program B is running, program C finishes its I/O. So after program C, we run program B, and then program C runs its I/O. Then program A's I/O finishes. So we start running program A, and while it's running, program B and C's I/O finish. So we run C first, then B, disregarding the order the I/O actually finished. So this schedule makes sense. Everyone see how we arrived at this? So something to note is because we're not doing preemption, we still have this convoy effect, that we still have these cases where we're waiting for this long-running A program because we don't do preemption. So this is one of the reasons why I mentioned priority schedulers. They want preemption. They want to avoid this problem when we have notion of priority. And here we want it to avoid waiting, the problem we're trying to avoid by running the shortest job first. That when we have to worry about IOs finishing at any time, like in the real world, that's going to be an issue. So we want to do this with preemption. So what does it look like to add preemption? Well, this is a bit tricky, actually. So when we add preemption, we can't just say, I'm going to always run B first, and then C, and then A. That's not always the right decision. And the reason is, what happens if A is almost done? If A is almost done, then we want to finish the almost done job sooner, because you know we can get that program. Otherwise, we'll be waiting longer than we need to. So instead of having our priority be the length of our CPU burst, it's going to change over time, and it's going to be the remaining time the program has left in its CPU burst. So if we stop, have this long job that's almost done, it has a higher priority now because it can finish really quickly, and if we don't let it finish really quickly, we're going to spend all that extra time waiting. Another way of thinking about it is we ignore what happened in the past and we only care about what's left for the programs to do, so we only care about remaining time. Either way, this is our preemptive policy. So shortest remaining time first, so we prioritize by the time that's left until they can give up the CPU. Which is again our notion of race to sleep. That we want to get things to sleep as fast as possible, we'll run whatever can go for. Whatever can stop using the CPU as quick as possible. Stop waiting. So if we apply that to this schedule, we get something a bit different. So here, I have program A running, program B finishes in the middle, and because program A has a little bit more work to do than the length of program B runs first. So B preempts A because it has less time left than A does. But later on, C does not preempt A because C has more time left than A does. even though A, CPU bursts are longer in general. And the notion is that if we ran C first, we'd add more waiting time to the system by the amount of time A would be waiting than having C wait that extra time. Okay. So questions about this decision here? So this is our shortest remaining time first. And it turns out you can prove that if you disallow preemption and intentionally leaving the CPU idle when something could run, shortest job first is the policy which minimizes turnaround and waiting time. And if you allow preemption and ignore context switching costs, SRTF is the policy that minimizes turnaround and waiting time. So note that we have to ignore some things here. So if you don't do preemption, then technically sometimes if you had an oracle, you could do better by saying, oh, I know that this thing is going to finish its I/O soon, and it should run earlier. So I'm going to leave the CPU idle until it's ready to run, then run it, then run the other thing, and you might do a little better. And for SRTF, if you, there's some going to be some cases where you're going to do a lot of context switches, and maybe you'd be better off not switching away to something that has less remaining time to avoid the context switch overhead. But if you ignore that, these are mathematically optimal algorithms. Okay, so questions? Please. And just as an aside on names, you'll sometimes see different names for these and different meanings for the names. I'm always going to use SRTF for a preemptive algorithm. With remaining time, and SJF for non-preemptive with total time, which is always the same as remaining time, because if it's total time, if you don't do preemption, you're only concerned about when the CPU burst starts. But you might see different naming in books and elsewhere. Just read the definition. Be careful, and I'll be careful on exams to specify that I mean explicitly preemptive or not preemptive, to be very clear. Okay, so then we have the policy that people were getting to that they're frustrated with is, well, these are great scheduling policies for minimizing turnaround time, meaning interactive systems. I press a key, the system responds fast to those key presses. And if it's a shared system, it responds fast to everyone's key presses as fast as possible. But we need to know how long the jobs are. We need to know the length of the CPU burst. So the question is, how do we do that? So one way we could think of doing this is we could ask. And for some types of systems, this is a real thing people do. So for batch job scheduling, we think of having a supercomputer where everyone's running big simulations. When you submit something to one of those machines, you'll say, this is something that's going to run for 3 hours. This is something which is going to run for 15 minutes. So for those systems, they can do shortest job first with the times the users provided. They can actually implement this. And maybe it might even be the case that the answers you get will not be completely wrong. Probably not. Users are really bad at telling you how long things will run. And how bad they are depends on what incentives you provide. So if you don't like punish them for giving wrong answers in any way, they're probably not going to adjust the number unless it breaks anything. And if you kill their program after they take more time than they said they would, they're going to give you longer times than they'll run. And so in practice, people do ask for this time, but you know, you have to realize that even when you ask for it, you're not going to get an accurate answer. And if you want to be most efficient, you need to deal with being wrong. Now, on something like a desktop, you could imagine maybe our web browser could tell us, hey, I do all this interactive stuff. I don't do long sequences of CPU. My typical CPU burst is in this range. And some other program could tell us other things. This is just not a thing we do, but you could imagine maybe doing that, giving that sort of hint. But we're going to use a different technique where we're going to try to guess what the length of the CPU bursts are by observing past program behavior. So that's going to be our trick. And we're going to first do this by sort of approximating this with priorities and round robin. So we're going to do this notion that we're going to have priorities, and our highest priority is we're going to put the things we think have very short CPU bursts. And we're going to ensure ourselves against them having long CPU bursts by running things at this priority with a very short time slice. Because we're saying that if you're at this priority, we think your CPU bursts are between 0 and 1 millisecond. And if we're wrong, what we want to say is, you shouldn't be there, and we're going to get you away from there. So the idea is that we want to end up where we've categorized our processes by the lengths of their CPU bursts, and we're going to give them that amount of time, and that's going to work out fine. So that's what we want to end up with. And you might say, so how are we going to figure out the length? And the answer is we're going to use heuristics. And the key heuristic we're going to use, the key guess about how things work, is that CPU bursts now are going to be like ones you have later. That if your program typically is spending a very short amount of time computing before doing the next I/O, it's likely to keep doing that in the future. Or if your program just uses the CPU forever, and then does a little I/O, after it gets back from that I/O, we're going to guess it's likely to use the CPU forever again. So we're going to guess that your past behavior is like your future behavior, and we're going to use that to try to assign you to the correct bucket. So basically the notion is we're going to look at how long you actually take, and based on that we're going to move you between these priority levels. So our priority should reflect the CPU burst length. And a way we can do this is for each of these priorities, we're going to run round robin with a different time quantum. So at priority 3, we're going to say we run these programs with round robin with a 1 millisecond time quantum. So we're going to stop them if they run for more than a millisecond. Here, 10, 20, and 100. And we're going to pay attention to, why did we stop running a program? Did we stop running it because it gave up the CPU? Or did we stop running it because it ran out of its time quantum? So if it ran out of its time quantum, if it used its whole time slice, that little piece of time we gave it, then we know it's in the wrong place. So if process A here runs for 10 milliseconds before, and we switch to process B, we're going to say, we were wrong about you, process A. You take more than 10 milliseconds to do your CPU bursts, so we're going to move it down to the next priority. Whereas if process A finishes early, we're going to say, oh, maybe you can take less than a millisecond, we're going to move you up. And the overall result, if that is, say, process A takes 5 milliseconds, it's going to oscillate between priority 3 and 2. That it's going to be at priority 3, it's going to take 1 millisecond and not be done, move down to priority 2. Then it's going to take the remaining 4 milliseconds and be done and move up to priority 3. And if process A takes 15 milliseconds, it's similarly going to alternate between priorities 2 and 1. So this notion is known as a multi-level feedback queue, that we use feedback from how the program actually behaved to move it to the right queue, the right level queue. And the idea is that it settles based on how long its CPU bursts are. And if the program has a consistent CPU burst length, it ends up in approximately the right bucket. There's some oscillation, but it's in the right area. And we end up running it in something which approximates shortest remaining time first. So questions on this idea? Yeah. The question is, are we preempting? Yes. Well, between different priorities, yes. In typical, yeah, you want it to be the case that if you only have process D running and then process A comes back from waiting, that you remembered you put it at priority 3 next time and you'll start it immediately.
But it seems like if you get into the situation again where low priority programs get started.
Yes, your question is, can't we still have starvation? And the answer is absolutely. Yes.
Also,
so the question is, does this take a lot of overhead? So it's not actually too bad in practice. So one way you can think about implementing this is that we have an array of linked lists for the queues, and we have a number index we store in each process saying what array it goes on when it starts waiting. So it's actually pretty simple, and like there's one Boolean if statement in our scheduler code to change that index number. So it's actually not that complicated to implement, which is why it's a pretty popular algorithm for doing scheduling. Yeah?
I feel like with that, you're always going to be bouncing between priorities. Is there one where like the pages run at a pretty good spot?
So the question is, you're concerned, you seem to be moving a lot between priorities. That's sort of an inevitable feature of this design. You might imagine, there might be modifications which don't do that. I haven't seen them. So one thing which might mitigate that is real versions of the system might have not 4 priority levels, but like 100 or something like that, which, you know, would make that effect not matter very much. That'd be one thing you could do if you were concerned about that rather than actually trying to have some heuristic to keep things in the same spot. Okay, other questions? Okay, so this is our multi-level feedback queue. So higher priority means you have a shorter time quantum. So basically we want to assign you the priority that you deserve based on your CPU burst length, and we just adjust it based on observing whether we were right or not each time we put you to sleep for some reason. We either put you on a ready queue or actually do IO for you. And it results in this oscillation where, assuming your program has a consistent CPU burst length, you end up at the right spot. So one question that was brought up is starvation. We'll get to that later. But there's actually a bigger thing people are concerned about with this algorithm, which is cheating. Notice that if you don't use all your time quantum, your priority increases. So if you want to run really fast on a system with multi-level feedback queuing, what you do is you do a little bit of CPU, and then you somehow yield the CPU. Like you do IO, you know, will complete really, really fast. And that's how you do your program. And now you get to run all the time to do your work. So by doing some extra IO that you don't care about, or yielding of the CPU, you run faster. So that seems like a problem. So that's a reason why you might not like this system, but it's kind of an inevitable consequence of going for this remaining time first, that if you manipulate your remaining time, if you can do that, you can do extra work and run faster. Okay. And the other issue was, as mentioned, starvation. And that's related to that cheating thing, that when I'm cheating, I'm going to keep every program from running for a while. But the other thing is starvation, that let's say I have an interactive program, so that has a really short CPU burst, and I have a whole bunch of programs that are in the middle. They're like processing data on disk, they have longer CPU bursts, but not really long, and I have my very long computation. My very long computation is going to be at the lowest priority because it never gives up the CPU voluntarily. Everything else does. I have a lot of other things. It's not going to get any CPU time, pretty much. Which is the intended effect, but you might not like this. And another reason you might not like this is if what if A stopped doing, is done with its computation and is taking keyboard input now? And I don't know it yet because I haven't run it. It changed from having really long CPU bursts to really short ones. So commonly, real implementations of this will just have like heuristics about starvation. They'll have like some rule that if I haven't run something for too long, increase its priority just in case. And other things like that, which go away with our SRTF goal, but we mentioned that fairness conflicted with all our other goals. And this is an example of where that happens. Okay, and that's where I'm finishing up today. So next time we'll talk more about scheduling things fairly.